Welcome to the 82nd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 79 years to the day that Len Hutton made his test debut for England, scoring 0-1 against New Zealand. Welcome to the podcast that, if we'd been around then, would certainly have insisted on him being dropped from the team.
And, of course, 7,000 runs and the captaincy of the England national team later. I think that just about sums up why you shouldn't be listening to Reverse Threat Radio. But if you do choose to continue listening, we've got all kinds of fun for you this week. We're going to be looking back, as ever, over recent events in the world of cricket, particularly in some of the more hidden corners of the world of cricket. I'm going to be talking about the birth of cricket footage in some of the earliest cricket films that are on record. And we're going to be reviewing the wonderful book First Tests by Steve Kinnane. So, Andy, it's been a few weeks since we last recorded. What's been keeping you occupied?
Well, I've for a long time been writing off ODIs as a format. I've assumed that they're not as thrilling as T20s, and they just don't have that capacity for epic storylines that test matches do. And yet the format seems to be stronger than ever. The England-Sri Lanka ODI series has started off really, really well. I mean, a wonderful back-and-forth contest at Trent Bridge, finishing with a six off the last ball finish. And this tri-series in the West Indies between South Africa, Australia and the Windies has produced some actually great cricket. On a little side note, I really love the return of tri-series. I used to think they were great fun. I don't know why we stopped doing them. And I think the interesting point is that the format in its own way is evolving. It's benefiting from the changes in 2020. And I think this slightly naive view that people like myself have taken, where actually it's kind of the worst of both worlds in some ways, is actually being proved wrong. It seems to still be taking some of those shifts in momentum that a good test match has and combining them with some of the thriller minute cricket that T20 gives you.
And I've always thought that there's something actually about the way that ODIs have an ebb and flow over the, you know, on T20s, it's possible for games to be on the whole very, very one-dimensional, really, because in order to lose 10 wickets in an innings, you have to, you know, either have an absolute collapse or you don't and you can hit all the way through to the end, whereas with a 50-over game, everything has to be paced in a much more kind of clever way. I think the other thing, and this has been what's been shown by the tri-series in the West Indies with obviously South Africa being knocked out, is that one day is a much, much more meaningful in terms of the ability to pitch smaller nations against bigger nations, or sort of less successful nations against more successful nations, simply because a T20, upsets happen and upsets will continue to happen just because of the shortness of the format. Whereas to win at the 50-50 game, you have to have a bit more than kind of luck on your side. So in terms of actually really giving an opportunity for the smaller teams to create meaningful victories against the bigger teams, the ODI will always be the format that does that.
Yeah, and I like the fact in terms of the responsibility it asks of the batsman. I think I do get a little bit frustrated with T20, this thing that, you know, you go out, swing, go cheaply, and you sort of think, well, I had to, it's T20. You know, the ODIs, there's this nice balance between, yes, you have to get on with it, but there's also a little bit more...
You have to build
an
innings.
Exactly, there's a little bit more of that level of test match responsibility. So I think, you know, if you'd asked me a couple of years ago, I would fully have and confidently have predicted the end of ODIs as a format. Now I reckon they almost certainly do have a future.
So we've been wrong on Len Hutton, we've been wrong on ODIs. Let's see what else we're going to be wrong on. So one of the things that I was kind of quite encouraged and surprised by was reading about the appointment of the new Afghan team's sort of national head coach, which is a chap called Lal Chand Rajput. I'm not sure if that's the right way to pronounce his name, but let's go with it. And it wasn't really a name that actually meant much to me until I looked him up. He was the coach of the Indian team that won the 2007 World T20, so he's got some impressive coaching credentials under his belt. And he also was a reasonably proficient first-class batsman. I think he's scored, you know, made a couple of test appearances for India. What I was surprised by was actually not in the first instance by Rajput himself, but was by the other contenders for that job as Afghan national coach, who were Herschel Gibbs, Corey Collamore and Mohammad Yusuf, all of them not necessarily players with huge coaching credentials under their belt, but certainly players with a lot of international cred, who you would think wouldn't have gone for that job unless they were actually, you know, they obviously weren't taking that job lightly.
It's a brilliant statement of other countries and other serious former internationals taking Afghanistan seriously. I agree with you. I think it's a real recommendation that I mean, as you say, they're not people who currently have a big coaching CV behind them, but they are very credible international cricketers who, if they see Afghanistan as a great place to start a coaching career, that is a real vote of confidence in where that country's cricket's going.
Now, obviously, in the UK, it's dancing happily in summer. Have you been enjoying any of the any cricket live?
I have. It's dancing happily into summer is an interesting way of phrasing it. British weather. I don't want to turn this podcast into a weather report, but it has been perversely tropical recently. We're getting a lot of these very like close mornings followed by thunderstorm afternoons, and it was on one such day this week that I set off to Lord's. And I don't think I've ever been less enthusiastic while walking down to Lord's. The rain was coming down in sheets. I and everyone else had their umbrellas up, but we had decided to put our faith in the Lord's ground staff to somehow get a game on after yet another day of thunderstorms, and in the BBC weather forecast that confidently said it was going to be dry from 7 o'clock. Amazingly, both of these things turned out to be true, and Middlesex versus Somerset began at 8 o'clock as an abridged 9-over game.
And not until not nine over for nine overs for each side.
Nine overs for each side. So, yeah,
Oh, great. Okay. What do
well,
you know what the minimum is for a game
that
to be completed?
I do now know what that is. So the minimum is 5 overs a side, and
Great.
if
Talking of
at
building an innings, yeah.
well, exactly, and actually, we were told on this evening. So the game was supposed to start at 6:15. The latest it could start was at 8:45 as a 5-over-a-side game. But you know, we were enriched by a whole, 10 at 9-over-a-side game. So I was, after all, going to get my chance to see Brendan McCullum bat at Lord's. He comes out to open for Middlesex, and the early signs aren't promising. He's comfortably being outscored by his partner, the very talented David Milan, who has just been picked in the England T20 side, actually, and looks like quite a prospect. And anyway, McCullum is playing and missing a lot. He finally edges one behind, and he's out for seven. But one batting great has failed me, but fortunately, Somerset have got one in their side as well. And about an hour later, Mahela Jayawardene comes to the crease. Now, if I was excited about McCullum, I'm probably even more excited about Jayawardene. I mean, it is an absolute pleasure to watch him bat. There is a sort of smoothness, there's a creativity about the way he plays his shots. Wonderful. Anyway, he smashes his very first ball towards point, where Paul Sterling, who, just for context here, if an Irish international cricketer and a quite a large chap, somehow just launches into the air and takes an absolute stunner at point. And I think the lesson you learn from this is that just do not go to cricket expecting your heroes to make runs for you on demand. The game is just far too cruel and tricksy for that.
I do remember going to a T20 game at the Oval when Kevin Peterson was playing there more regularly, and clearly a lot of the team had. It was I can't remember whether it's his first game there or his last game there, and quite a lot of the crowd had obviously turned up just to see him, and he made a scratchy three or something and then holed out to mid wicket, and you could just feel the entire ground just completely lose interest in the game at that point. And obviously there is so much more beyond that. How did the game pan out
Well,
generally? Was it a was it an interesting
it
game?
was an extremely good game actually, and went to the final ball where Somerset needed six off the final ball and didn't get it. On your subject of the crowd being very disappointed, what I rather loved with Jayawardene's dismissal is Lewis Gregory, the bowler, couldn't really bring himself to celebrate. He looked slightly shocked as he realised what he had done. It was almost as if he perhaps was a bit of a Jayawardene fan and was thinking, "Oh, I was hoping to, I was hoping for you to smash
Have
me
a bit
around a
more of a
little
bowl at you.
bit."
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Now
So obviously
you, despite being on the other side of the planet, have managed to get upset and anxious by something that's making, well, everyone here a bit upset and anxious.
Well, yeah, and actually, I think the news of the Brexit referendum has been keenly observed the world over, really. Certainly down here in Australia. And obviously it's early days, and there are a lot of questions that are yet to be resolved in terms of the UK's withdrawal from the EU. One thing, though, is which has obviously been keeping me awake at night, is what is the impact going to be on cricket? And so I decided to look into this a little bit earlier. And really, there are a couple of things which the ECB is really going to have to give a lot of thought to, and actually is going to be out of their control in terms of the way that. the movement of people within and outside the EU is able to happen after the withdrawal. The first one of which is that in the past, it's been very easy from players from other nations within the EU to work, obviously, within the UK. Work visas are kind of freely given between, in fact, you don't even need to have a visa, I don't think, to work within EU countries. And what that has meant is that those few players that have come out of countries in the EU who have needed first-class cricket have been able to very easily go and play in the only EU country, or previously EU country, which has a substantial first-class setup, which is, of course, the UK. After the UK leaves the EU, that'll be a lot more difficult. It'll be even more difficult because, actually, at the moment, the rule is that there can only be one player from overseas that plays in every county side, and EU players don't at the moment count as overseas. So at the moment, counties are actively incentivized to take players from other nations within the EU and include them in their team as kind of home players. But once the UK leaves the EU, they'll count as that international player. And you know, why would you go for your Dutch player over your, you know, glitzy Australian import or something like that? The other effect is on the infamous COLPAC agreement, which allows for players from the Caribbean, South Africa and Zimbabwe to play sport freely in EU countries. The COLPAC agreement presumably won't hold in the UK after the UK leaves the EU, which means that actually, you know, from those three countries that have, you know, significant numbers of good cricket players, that they won't be able to play in the UK anywhere near as easily as they have in the past. So certainly there's going to need to be a lot of renegotiation in terms of the way that international players can come and play in the UK if we're going to continue to be a, you know, substantial international hub for cricketers.
I think we're obviously, like with its impact on cricket, like its impact on anything else, we're still at the early stages of working out what on earth's going on. But at the same time, it is kind of an interesting indication of just how broadly the impact could end up being felt. The fact that even in county cricket, this is something that people are going to have to come to terms with. From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to take us back to the birth of cricket on film.
So this feature was inspired by a present that I found on my desk at work one morning. So I work at the ABC, the Australian equivalent of the BBC, and frequently there are clear outs of sample stock. So there are CDs and DVDs and books and, you know, occasionally a kind of plush kids toy lying around that we can all help ourselves to. And usually they're unwanted and, you know, the kind of stuff you can't give away. But occasionally there are some real gems in there. And this one, a colleague had thought was particularly suited to me. And it's a DVD with an eminently retro cover. And the title on it proclaims The Cricket Archives, Australian Cricket Films 1905 to 1961. And I brought it home, and I must confess that it's been sitting at home for the last 3 months. And mostly while I spend all of my time watching black and white cricket footage on YouTube, I kind of thought to myself, why do I have to get out of the DVD player to watch this? However, eventually I thought, you know, maybe this will be something interesting. And as the title suggests, the DVD surveys over half a century worth of cricket footage, mostly Australian cricket footage, with commentary that is, you know, occasionally illuminating, that comes from Don Bradman, as well as some cameo appearances by the likes of Neil Harvey and Gary Sobers. The thing that really intrigued me wasn't so much this commentary, but was actually the story behind the development of film and the development of cricket film, which was something that actually I'd never really thought about at all. So cricket began to be filmed in the early 1900s, which is really when the technology was in its infancy. The one thing about this early footage is that, of course, there's no audio with it. It wasn't actually possible to record live audio and put it onto the same tapes as the film went onto. And there are particular moments when you think that this is a real pity, particularly when you see something like, for instance, footage of the 1925 Ashes tour, when 236,000 people, isn't that astonishing, went to see the test at the MCG. And among that crowd were three players, and you see pictures of them in the footage, who actually played in Australia's very first test in 1877 and also played in the game at the Oval in the UK that gave birth to the Ashes, and it's at moments like that that you really wish that there was audio, because then you can imagine having an actual taped interview with these people would be absolutely astonishing.
Although the other side of it is, I sometimes think when you see this old footage without audio, there is something actually quite compelling about just the silent pictures. You know, it focuses you totally on the image of the time and on the and it is obviously such a contrast to now, where there's such a conscious attempt to get crowd noise exactly right. You know, if you listen to if you watch a modern test match, or if you watch a football game now, you know, there's a really effort to get into sound. So actually watching it in total silence and focusing just on what's going on, I guess has its own charm.
Yeah, and absolutely. In a way, I think the sound is sometimes a distraction. But certainly when sound first came in, which was around 1930, there was a lot of excitement around this. And actually, very sadly, there was a real sense of, well, all of this old footage that doesn't have any audio with it, it's kind of useless and obsolete now. So actually, a lot of the early cricket footage, there was a lot taken and very little of it survived, simply because there was this thought of, oh, well, you know, all of this old archive without any sound, we can just destroy it. So lots of it literally was just chucked out.
I find that just extraordinary, because it obviously means at the time there was no sense that what we would now look back on some of, you know, the founding
really
of the modern game.
Archives, yeah, absolutely.
But maybe that's inevitable. I think, at the present you don't see that what you're dealing with is going to in the future be seen as, you know, of historic importance.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the thing was that this technology was moving on so quickly that there was a kind of sense of, you know, who would want these old, you know, these old. And I think it happened actually with photographs quite a lot as well, that a lot of photographs were destroyed because there was a sense of, well, now, you know, cricket is the same now as it was 30 years ago. And if we can now take moving footage with audio, why do we need all of the other stuff that's been there, that's been taken before? One of the other, you know, there were certain limitations, obviously, to film that carried on after that 1930 sort of watershed moment, one of which was that there were no long lenses, so everything had to be shot from the perspective of a spectator in the crowd. So obviously everything's a long way away from the action. There were a couple of ways around this. One of which I find, you know, quite amusing, which is this idea that if you actually put the picture in a circle, so rather than having a kind of square view, you have a circular view, it kind of tricks the viewer into thinking that they're looking down a telescope, and so therefore makes you kind of think as if you're, you know, seeing it more up close than you actually are, which, you know, kind of doesn't really work at all, but was thought to be quite a good way of doing it for a while. The other more practical way of getting around this was that actually a lot of the, when you wanted to film players up close, you literally had to do that. You had to do it out of match situations. And so all of this footage that we now have that is of, you know, when you see the footage of, you know, Don Bradman playing as forward defensive, it's all done, you know, sort of on a training ground and the camera's literally 10 meters away from him. And that's simply because of the lack of long lenses that were there at the time. And actually this in itself spawned this new genre kind of almost of film, which was where particularly ex-players who, you know, needed some money from somewhere, they would actually create these kind of coaching videos where they would, you know, go to a practice ground somewhere and get a film crew a few meters away from them and film in close-up demonstrations of the way that certain shots should be played, or bowled, you know, balls should be bowled or something like that.
Was the driver for all of this, was it purely commercial? I mean, what was this being driven by enterprising businessmen who are, you know, who almost had, I guess, a distant eye on the future we have today, where, you know, far more people than are in the ground are watching this distantly, or is this sort of cricket fanatics just wanting to try and, I mean, do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, it's mostly actually news. So one of the first moving film units in Australia was run by one of the kind of gazettes, the daily newspapers, and they saw this as a really, really engaging way of being able to get, you know, spreads, you know, sort of add an extra media arm literally to their media output. And one of the things that happened a lot of the, you know, in the early 1900s is that outside newspaper offices, they would update, they'd have a scoreboard on the officer in the middle of the city, you know, miles away from the cricket ground. They'd have a scoreboard that they would actually update in kind of as close to real time as they could. And you'd actually get crowds who would, you know, didn't have radios. Radios were very expensive, and obviously TV didn't exist. And they would gather around these scoreboards. And as, you know, a wicket went up or something, everyone would cheer. And, you know, this amazing sense of them realizing that a way to bring people together around their products was to, you know, give them engaging ways of interacting with the sport that reached out to so many people. So actually, a lot of the early cricket films were directly funded by news organizations. Another way that actually that a lot of the early footage was taken up was by amateur filmmakers. And the Australian leg spinner Clary Grimmett, actually there's some brilliant footage. He was a keen amateur filmmaker, and he had a pretty, you know, sort of cheap and cheerful camera, about as cheap and cheerful as cameras got in those days, because actually of course they were very expensive indeed, and the film was very expensive. And when the Australian team was touring in the 1930s, Grimmett would take this camera around and film the team, you know, back in the day when the team came to Europe and they would do their, you know, 3 months traveling around Europe. He filmed all of this, and a lot of that film footage still exists. And so you see the players, you know, whatever it is, going to Rome and bathing in a fountain and all of that kind of thing. And actually it makes you think that nowadays we feel like we have, you know, much better access to the England team through social media and stuff like that. But that actually this really candid footage is much, much more sort of revelatory and explicit in the, you know, non-explicit way than the kind of really kind of mediated access to teams that we have in the 21st century.
I guess in this instance there was a genuine excitement and willingness of the players to just take part and engage, whereas exactly as you say now, I'm sure a lot of the players are positive about engaging with their fans, but they do so through a kind of slightly world-weary media trained.
Yeah.
I guess it's a difference maybe in motivation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think whilst the something that you touched on earlier, whilst this footage is in many ways really limited, often there's no audio, often it's so grainy that you can't actually see the ball. Often the cameras are static, so that you have a you know, the image is the wicket itself, and you can't actually see if someone plays if someone edges the ball, you can't see if it's been caught in the slips or has gone for four. You know, there are huge limitations to all of this footage, but actually, in terms of being able to engage with that past world of cricketers that otherwise would just have absolutely no access to, it's absolutely invaluable. And one thing that really was struck home to me by this DVD was watching Warwick Armstrong, who was the Australian bowler who was known as the Big Ship. He was known as the Big Ship for several reasons, one of which was that he weighed about 20 stone. And actually, I've read a lot about him, and Gideon Hay wrote a brilliant book about him. But actually, there is nothing like actually watching him in action. That you suddenly, this whole myth around this guy who was 20 stone and had an appalling depression, you suddenly see him bowling, and this remarkably agile bowler who you suddenly see, that is brought to life by film in a way that it just can't be by any other view of the past that we have. So, to the book review, and for this episode, we have been reading Steve Kinnane's book First Tests, which is subtitled Great Australian Cricketers and the Backyards That Made Them. Now, Steve Kinnane is not necessarily known as a cricket writer. In fact, as far as I know, this is the only book that he has ever written on cricket. Instead, he is more an investigative journalist who has worked for many years in Australia in a number of capacities at the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and who now lives in London, reporting for the ABC's Europe Bureau. So tell us a bit about this book, Andy.
In one sense, it's a very simple premise of a book. As the subtitle said, it's about those initial steps that famous Australian Test cricketers took as children. And you can read it as just a series of entertaining anecdotes. You've got all these cricketers who went on to stunning success, and they all began in sort of very different ways. But I think actually, taken all together, it builds up something quite more, which is a bit of a thesis on how great cricketers are actually made. And you start, as you read these different stories, to bring out the common themes. One thing that I think was overwhelmingly striking for me was this obsession with detail that a lot of these great players had, even as children. In this case, Clary Grimmett, this is now as an adult, I love this fact, he specially ordered the same soil that was being used at the MCG pitch and had that brought to his backyard to make a pitch that accurately replicated it. And I think, you know, already there you're thinking that is a level of obsession that is goes well beyond the normal, the average, or even the quite passionate cricket player.
So obviously that's Clara Grimmett at the towards the end of his life when he moved up to North Sydney. He actually kind of created a kind of backyard cricket pitch that he kind of laid himself and had his own kind of, he was the groundsman to it. I think the other side of that though, in terms of detail, is that often cricketers are formed by the details that are sort of already made for them, in the sense that, you know, there are lots of stories of the cricketers who, you know, learn to play particular shots. So for instance, Steve Waugh learned to play the flick to mid wicket, you know, more than any other shot, because actually in the garden in which he played, that was the only place in which he wouldn't get out by, you know, hitting it over the washing line, which was automatically out, and that kind of thing. So actually the details kind of work in both directions. And one thing that came across really strongly for me was the way that just these kind of historical accidents almost actually really affect the ways in which cricketers develop in kind of, you know, very small things that actually are then writ large on their careers.
I think it's a really interesting distinction, the things that young cricketers almost had done to them by their circumstance and the things that they chose. I mean, one story that comes out in here that is not new, it's probably the most told story of childhood cricket practice in history, is the Don Bradman golf ball single stump practice routine. But what Canaan brings out about that is that this wasn't just the sort of odd way of practicing, it was an unbelievably productive way of practicing. The young Bradman had really worked out, in Canaan's words, to how you maximize the number of balls faced before mum called you in for dinner. This is more than just a novelty, it's actually about how do you practice as well as you as can. One, I think, comparison you keep making as you go through the book is the relative toughness of the upbringings. I think you have certain people inevitably who grew up in relatively prosperous backgrounds, others who grew up in really hard ones, and I think there's an ongoing theme that Canaan, I think, is keen to bring out, that quite a lot of Aussie Test cricketers, and I mean Aussie cricket more than maybe any others, there's this culture of toughness, this culture of the hard man. So many Aussie Test cricketers came through tough street cricket, or they came through tough sibling rivalry, that was always part of what made them.
And certainly there are those cricketers who kind of really engaged with that. So there are the stories of the great stories of Sid Barnes growing up in Stanmore, where I was for dinner just the other night, in fact. And he kind of becomes a sort of, you know, almost the mafia of the local cricket scene. You know, he is quite, you know, quite a savvy child, and he buys up the old bats and balls from Sydney University, the second-hand bats and balls, and because he's got a sort of monopoly on them, he's then able to control, you know, who plays when and things like that. And they, you know, have this whole setup for how they avoid the police, who are after them because they've broken a whole load of windows as well. I think there's also the other side of it, which is the cricketers who are shaped by the circumstance of as much as anything just being bored. There's the great story of Bill O'Reilly and the fact who, you know, he grew up in outback New South Wales, where there was kind of really nothing to do as a child, and so he just spent hours and hours and hours. His brother Jack went to see Arthur Mailey, the spinner, bowling, and wrote back and told his brother Bill about Arthur Mailey's technique. And because he had nothing else to do, he took this letter and he just recreated it, and he just, you know, just through bowling again and again and again and again. And so, you know, there are those two sides of the way that, you know, social circumstance can shape what the way that you approach your kind of practice.
Agreed. I think the boredom point is very interesting. I mean, I think it was impossible to read this without thinking about Malcolm Gladwell, who's been heavily, heavily quoted, his thesis that you need 10,000 hours of practice at anything to become a genius. And it was, I had that kept coming up in my mind, because you think these are people for whom at a very early stage cricket became everything, and whatever natural talent they had, you felt like this obsessive practice was crucial on top of it. One sort of cliche that I think is always brought up in terms of sporting success, but I think is a cliche for good reason, the idea of the pushy parent. And there is a wonderful quote from Martin Chappell, father of the Chappell brothers, when he's asked, what did you do to create these wonderful Test cricketers? And he said, I gave up all my spare cash, all my leisure time, and about 150 broken windows. Which I think does give you a sense, doesn't it, of it's not just the player themselves who's having to make a sacrifice.
Yeah, there's an interesting other side to that though, which is not necessarily the parents who want their children to be great and to live through that greatness necessarily, but it's actually those parents who are actually being selfless in it as well. There's the great story of the great batsman Victor Trumper, who grew up in Surrey Hills, which at that time was a real slum, and his father Charlie took him every morning before work to play cricket in Moor Park because he thought that it was the only way to actually kind of keep him out of trouble was to give him something else, something that he could really sort of engage with. So actually those relationships between the, you know, whether a parent is a pushy parent for the kind of wrong reasons or the right reasons is actually kind of quite complex, I think, is what comes across.
I think aside from the whole issue of player development, this book also appeals to a part of all of our natures where we look at great cricket players and we want great stories, great origin myths behind them. And I reckon, I mean, that's definitely part of the driver, I think, in why Kinnane wrote this book, that you really want these legends. And again, the book doesn't disappoint. There are some wonderful stories. There are some very, very few of these people had almost, there's very little routine about any of them. There's always something interesting. I also very much enjoyed, and you probably have a far better view on this because you now know all these parts of, well, certainly Sydney that are referred to. There's a wonderful nostalgia to the book where Kinnane ends each chapter by slightly lamenting basically how soft modern Australia has become. And I love when he talks about the impossibility of playing street cricket in modern day Surrey Hills. He declares it wouldn't be the done thing to slog a dirty tennis ball into someone's Caesar salad. There's something wonderful about this kind of, oh, it was better in the old days, wasn't it?
Well, I think definitely knowing Surrey Hills quite well, there probably wouldn't be many opportunities to play street cricket there. I did used to live in Paddington, which is a suburb next to Surrey Hills in Sydney, and we had a kind of back lane that we used to occasionally play cricket in. And we did actually once come up against a situation where at kind of cow corner, there was someone's garden with a tall wall around it, and after a few beers, quite a lot of tennis balls ended up going into cow corner, and one of us shimmied over a wall to see if we could get it back, only to be faced by the guy who lived there, who was a sort of guy in his 70s, you know, reasonably amiable. We'd come across him a bit in the past. We asked him for the tennis balls back, and he said, no, in my day we would have learned not to hit the ball there. You can't have them back. It'll teach you. Which maybe actually backs up Steve Kinnane's point after all.
Thank you for joining us for the 82nd episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. If there is anything on the episode that you'd like to discuss further, then get in touch with us on Twitter at Reverse Sweat. And if you did enjoy the show, then tell a friend or family member about us, or just, you know, tell a random person in the street how much you love Reverse Sweat Radio. And we would also always appreciate if you fancy heading down to iTunes and saying nice things about us in a review.